Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, your Week in IndyCar listener Q&A show. It is Monday, May the 13th. It's about 10 p.m. or so, getting this done while my wife is sleeping. Big thanks to our pal Jerry Siddeth, who put all the questions together for us, puts them in a entertaining order, does this for us each week. Great friend, greatly appreciated, Jerry. Thanks to y'all for the many questions you sent in. Jerry says about 3,300 words and over 60 questions this week. Going to try and do our best to get back on schedule with doing the faster and shorter episodes, which I have been liking. I'm going to give you a quick personal update first and then roll into our show. Was meant to fly out to Indy, as you probably heard me say a couple of times on Sunday. Got home from the WeatherTech Sports Car Championship IMSA race in Monterey Saturday and was meant to do laundry and get repacked and head out the door Sunday morning. My wife, Chabrelle, said, hey, we need to talk, and shared with me that while I'd been away, and I guess a day or two prior, some things had changed pretty seriously in the chemo that she's been on, and shared with y'all a couple months ago, I think, early March, that the chemo we had been on had stopped working. Our oncologist had said, hey, we're going to give this a trial and bump up the horsepower on it, and hopefully that'll reignite things. And that seemed to work for a little while, but that had stopped. And yeah, returned hardcore and quickly. So that made getting on a plane to go do things like covering a motor race by no means top priority. So been trying to fit in my normal work and whatnot in and around her sleep schedule. This stuff knocks her out pretty heavily. So able to, whether it's in the couch or here in the office, get through a number of things. So time is right here to try and get this done and get this out to y'all. So this Tuesday is going to be a really important day. We have a kind of impromptu meeting with our oncologist, and we will find out what the plan of action is. If we can get things working again and get back on a good plan of action, and she is stable and everything is good, then I will look to try and get on a plane to Indy. I don't know when that is. Is that Thursday, Friday, Saturday, next week? Not at all. I don't know. All predicated upon what we learn on Tuesday, what is prescribed, and then I'm going to need to spend a couple of days home with her just to see how side effects go and whether they are manageable or not. And if they are, bearing in mind that we have been in this fight for about 6 years now, we've been through this many times. I missed three straight Indy 500s from 2019 through 2021 while being home, taking care of her, taking care of more important things. So want to be in Indianapolis because I love it. It is my job. It is how I support us. But I'm also very thankful to my clients, Racer being my primary client, saying take care of business at home. Do not worry about a single thing outside of home. And that is indeed where my focus is. Just to share with y'all so you understand, because I'm sure some of y'all would be like, I wouldn't do a single ounce of work, et cetera, while this is going on. That's what I did the first year or two, but I can tell you that having been through this for a really long time and its seemingly frequent recurrences, one thing I am not good at being is idle. So sitting and stewing with nothing to do and having all this weighing on my mind and spirit is the last thing that I need. So that is why you have seen probably some stories coming out from me today, even yesterday, and we'll be seeing more, not because I have some maniacal need to do work, but because sitting and stewing and having all of this weighing on me with no other distractions is not what is best for me. I know that, have learned that, and will adhere to that here going forward. So, bottom line, appreciate y'all. Your support and kindness is just, it's a elixir for sure, and has been for many years. So we'll find out what the plan is. I'll let y'all know here as soon as I can about what I will or won't be doing. I know we're supposed to be doing all kinds of meetups in Indy and going to do this and do that and go see a Indiana Fever game and all kinds of fun things. I'm supposed to host the last row party. I'm supposed to do this, that, and the other. And hopefully I can still do all those things. Updates to follow. All right, let's say a big thank you to those who do indeed make the show possible from our partner standpoint. And then we will kick off the show. Time to say a big thank you to our show partners on the Marshall Pruitt podcast, starting with Pfaff Technologies, build-to-print composites manufacturing company. They're specializing in medium to large-scale automotive, motorsports, and military applications. Visit pfafftechnologies.com. It's P-F-A-F-F technologies.com to learn more about their services and how they can benefit your business. Next, it's the Justice Brothers, makers of premium additives, lubricants, and cleaners, and servicing the automotive and motorsports industries for more than 85 years, with victories in all the biggest North American motor races, including the Indianapolis 500, the 24 Hours of Daytona. The Justice Brothers products are truly race-proven. Learn about their vast history and range of offerings at justicebrothers.com. If you're fond of awesome motor racing collectibles, including Pfaff Motorsports McLaren gear and goodies, pay a visit to torontomotorsports.com. And finally, we have a new online merchandise home for the podcast, thepruittstore.com, for all the show stickers, models, racing memorabilia I'm trying to sell and put towards our fund to buy a house is now live and rocking, thepruittstore.com. Raymond Wong, you open the show. You say, why does Santino Frucci get the hate for most fans for supposed rough driving and easing drivers off the track when Romain Grosjean does the same thing and fans give him a pass for it? I'll take Santino because he's ballsy and unapologetic while Romain plays it up like a diva. And to hear him whine when he gets pushed around on the radio, etc., etc. I think, Raymond, it's just a case of sympathy versus a total lack of sympathy. In light of the things that Santino was accused of doing back towards the end, what ended up being the end of his European open wheel career, be it racist things, be it just bratty, defiant things. For those who know that story, it seems like those folks, I shouldn't say all, but it seems like many of the folks who were angry about all of that back then, and I'm not saying that they were wrong for being angry about it, but there seems to be, as I have perceived, Raymond, a real heavy spiritedness to holding on to that and never letting it go. I like to think people can change or improve. I don't know if change completely is where Santino was at. I mean, I say that because I don't know, right? Would just say that Santino, for those who know the backstory, comes into things with no line of credit to draw from. Romain, on the other hand, in light of his story, the Phoenix nearly dying or the potential of dying, the burns and so on, becoming globally popular as a result of that crash and surviving it and his story of survival, he is among IndyCar's most popular drivers, and I think therefore gets the benefit of the doubt more likely or more often than a Santino would. So I think it's as simple as that. Jordan Darwin, you say, MP, continue prayers for you and your bride. Thank you, brother. Say, the Santucci and Gross Jeans feud reminds me of the hate between drivers that our beloved Robin Miller used to look forward to writing about. Do the drivers or IndyCar need to smooth this out before the Indy 500? Yeah, so great question, Jordan. They do. It does. And I don't know if I would say this is something specific to Santino and Romain. I would say in general, there needs to be a get your effing bleep together message from IndyCar, from race director Kyle Novak, from IndyCar president Jay Fry. Many, the vast majority of the drivers in question here, Jordan, blameless, behaved wonderfully, well, good, upstanding members of the community, and so on. There are no critical notes to offer them in terms of their driving standards, behavior, and so on. But there are a couple, and it could be growing. There are some who for sure need to have the hammer dropped on them. And so what comes to mind here is one key thing, and it has really stood out to me more and more this season, late last season, than any other time I can remember, and it's this. There is no fear among the driver base of anything, of each other, of retaliation, of anything. Cars are crazy safe. It's been a super long time since anybody was seriously injured. A lot of safety modifications to the cars have come in reaction to the injuries, fatalities suffered as well during the DW12 era, or fatality, I should say. There's no fear in how each other go through a corner, treat each other, push each other off, bang wheels, hit each other, clip each other, nose each other, etc. There's also, which to me is, I don't even know if it's secondary, Jordan. It might actually be the primary thing. There's no fear when it comes to the drivers from the series. There's no sense of, oh man, if I act out, if I, as Santino, decide to rough up this driver and that driver and knock him off track and push him off and do all these kinds of things, am I truly worried that somebody at IndyCar is really going to come down hard on me? Not at all. You might get a drive-through penalty. You might get a, who knows what, financial penalty. You might lose some points. Again, okay, got it. Are these things, these types of penalties going to turn a repeat offender, repeatedly aggressive driver, knocking around others and whatnot, from ever doing it again? I haven't seen it. I haven't seen evidence of such. There's one other subcomponent to this just to mention before we close, and that is part of the reason why drivers are not afraid of anybody at IndyCar coming down on them, wearing them out, beating them up. I'm not talking physically knocking them out, but like there's no sense of dread or fear of repercussions because such things are so often intentionally not handled by the series. No intervention. A approach of, well, let the drivers handle it among themselves. There is no handling between themselves. There is no, hey, we got together before the session and all the drivers yelled at the one or two who are acting bad. It's just do what you want on the track. And for the most part, IndyCar will not insert itself in the equation. So the thing, coming back to your primary question that I think needs to happen, is there needs to be a really nasty message that is sent, loud, lots of curse words, and no cameras, no PR reps, no communications people from the series, truly. No team managers, closed door. Look, you bleeps, it stops here. I remember an incident with my father when I was a kid where between myself and my two stepbrothers, one of us had done something very wrong. And I've told this before, I won't go into the full details just to not repeat myself, but the two of us knew, and we knew, my dad knew, the two out of the three of us were completely innocent, but he wore out all three of us to make sure it was known that this would never happen again. Of course, IndyCar officials can't get physical with their drivers, nor should they. But the absolute lack of fear that exists, that needs to be erased. I don't know what the penalties would be, but get into them. Put them out there that are so big and scary, and then act upon them if those things are breached, that folks go, holy crap, I absolutely will never run that guy off the track again. If I'm in a 50-50 situation, I'm going to embrace my inner angels and let that go. Because if I were to tip that driver into a spin, even if it was totally unintentional, the repercussions would be so severe that it's not even worth trying to let it happen and then explain my way out of it. So it's the lack of fear. It's the lack of willingness, Jordan, to insert themselves in these situations as they're happening and developing. That is what needs to be cured. Why don't we go to Chris Kalewick? How you doing, Chris? It's a question on the strategy for Christian Lindgaard. They opted on the third stop to go with sticker primaries, not the alternates. After having luck with them in the beginning of the race, you say Alex Palou, the race winner, pulled away with alternates, but with primaries supposing to last longer, why didn't they try to run long, try and snag back the lead? It says it seemed to work for Scott McLaughlin. Would it have worked for Lundgaard? Possibly. If you look at the way that they went with Lundgaard, it's pretty interesting where started off on brand new primaries, went to used alternates, then went to used primaries and closed on new alternates, according to what I'm looking at here on the Firestone site. At least for looking at Alex Palou's strategy, he started on used alternates, then went to used primaries, used alternates, and closed on new alternates, just like Lundgaard. So the only difference between the guy who sat on pole and won the race and Lundgaard, who started alongside of him and finished third, is Christian started on the slower tires, Alex started on the faster tires, and they ended up finishing on the same new alternates. McLaughlin obviously had a fair amount of positions to make up. He started on new alternates, closed on new alternates, and did used alternates in between, and then also a new set of primaries. So could they have done things a bit different with Lundgaard? Of course. At least for what they attempted to do. Again, going by what Firestone has here on their site that they keep. This is pretty awesome, by the way. It's livetiming.net/Firestone for those of you who don't know and don't tell anybody. It's really cool. And this is actually updated live on road and street courses, so you can see who's using what, who changes to what, how long they're on those tires. It's pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, this to me doesn't look like on the RLL side there that they did anything particularly wrong and such for Lundgaard. They just thought that that was going to be the best way forward. And yeah, I mean, the only time Palou went a couple laps, one or two, maybe longer, on that second stint with his used primaries compared to Lundgaard, who, again, went one or two laps, one lap, I think, shorter on used alternates. So, again, other than that, there was nothing that stands out to me here as like, oh, boy, they really got this wrong or that wrong. Charles Napier, say, Marshall, what is the issue with Marcus Ericsson? We all thought the issue with the 28 car was Romain Grosjean. However, so far, Romain is outperforming Marcus. Romain put the 28 car way up farther in the grid with pole position and whatnot, legitimate chances to win. You say none of that has happened so far with Marcus. Yeah, I need to talk to our guy, Mr. Erickson, about this because it's a bit of a curiosity for me as well. I mean, I don't want to write things off, of course, with 4 points paying races in the books alone. But yeah, you can see that, at least in the championship, Romain, in a smaller team, much less wealthy team, is 14th in the standings, whereas Marcus is 15th. They both had, call it, equally bad starts to the season. Marcus was on pace for what looked like a top five, maybe even a podium, possibly, until had a motor issue. It's actually an air feed issue to the motor that knocked him out while running super well. Did back that up right after it. And I'm just ignoring the thermal club because none of that stuff counts or mattered. But he did back that up with a fifth place run at Long Beach. So that was really positive. Barber, nothing great or spectacular there, if I remember. I think he was on the wrong strategy, as about half the field happened to be. And then last weekend, obviously, getting into it with Colton did not help. I mean, I'm overstating the obvious here, but that was one of those... I kind of hate this saying, but it always works. You can't win the race on the first lap, but you sure can lose it. I don't know if Marcus was destined to win the race, but he certainly didn't help himself within the team dynamic by getting into Colton Herta and nerfing him off and pissing off Colton to no end. Colton, by the way, if there's an award for guy who burns the brightest anger type vibe, who is seething but has a really good poker face, like, you could tell he was agitated in the post-race interview. I believe Kevin Lee was the one who spoke with him. And, yeah, I mean, you could see that he was seething, but, like, if there's an award for least demonstrative way to show you're super pissed off, it's going to go to Colton. Because, yeah, it's all about facial expressions and words compared to gesticulating and red-faced venom and whatnot. So, anyways, little observation there that means nothing, but I find somewhat interesting. Need to get with Marcus and see what's going on. He is very fast and very good. His race engineer, Olivier Boisson, is super extra good. The team is very good. They were on pace for a great result at the first race. They got a great result with fifth at the second race. The last two have been a bit of a slide, the most recent being a judgment error that certainly hasn't helped. Does that mean the season's lost? No, of course not. We're at the place where he seems to come to life every year. So, assuming Andretti's cars are quick-ish at Indy, my guess is he's going to get back on track, be in a good place, and probably have some very good points in hand to move himself higher up in the standings where he deserves to be. I will just say, it would surprise me if this happens, but if the month of May is more problems, lack of speed, hits the wall, whatever it might be, or race day ends up being a mess, I think there's going to be a very serious conversation between himself and Michael Andretti saying, dude, this ain't it. What do we need to do to get back on track to where we were those first couple of races? Not the time where they can afford to have a slide. Ben Cohen, you're wondering what happened to Linus Lundqvist. Said he was running in the top 10, then something went awry. I believe on the broadcast they mentioned something about gearbox problems. Oh, or it might have been post-race. So, yeah, that's what I seem to recall. Some sort of gearbox issues, and yeah, knocked out Linus from having another decent result. Why don't we go to Andrew Miller talking about Rinus VK. Seeing his side pods remain blank since St. Pete, Is this still an expected gap in sponsorship? Or are they running into sponsor payment issues? These were planned, expected, however, I shouldn't say planned, like they want them to be empty, but this is something where they went into the season without a number of races sold in terms of primary sponsorship. I've asked the team twice now if there's any value or help in writing a story saying, hey, a really good team with a really good driver, if you weren't aware, has some availability if you want to take part. Do those stories a couple times a year at least, whether it's IndyCar, IMSA, wherever, where you do look at something where you go, well, maybe the wider world does not know that this opportunity exists. We want to see all teams succeed, in the sports to succeed, the series to succeed. And in both instances, the team has said, thanks, we'll let you know, and never followed up, which tells me that they are not interested in that story being written. So, I guess they're funding it themselves somehow. Neil Doiker, how you doing, brother? He says, I'm a big Graham Rahal fan. During his interviews, he's always remarking how the team, engineers, and the crew are lost or having no luck or fielding a terrible car. I understand this weekend had many downs, the Indy GP, but how do these comments feed? How do these comments feed a culture of defeatism or foster resentment within the team and crew? Yeah, how's this? Graham's driven for the family-owned team for, what, a decade now? If he were a year one driver at the team, I'd say such things would definitely have a cultural impact that was negative. The fact that, again, anecdotally, we're like year 10 or whatever it is, I don't think that these come across as anything overly damaging now, because it's nothing new. Graham's disenfranchisement with whatever, he's not the guy to say when asked on camera or whatever, you know, we missed it for whatever reason. I probably gave the team bad feedback. I could have done this better. I. And even if everything about that would be false and he had done nothing wrong and he gave them perfect feedback, that hasn't been him. And he knows his reputation. He knows he mentions it in about half of his interviews that he knows folks. The average fan thinks of him as a whiner and a complainer and so on. He's really smart, really talented, and really, really can make any adjustments to how he responds and how he presents his thoughts and words to the public. And as we've seen for many years now, this is his preferred style, and this is what you get. So I don't think anyone on the team is going to come away feeling, oh, what did he say? Oh, my goodness. Like, no, you know, if we have a bad day, if we have anything other than a podium day, this is probably what you're going to get from Graham. And if you know that, as a former IndyCar crew member, team member, there are some drivers whose comments you really listen to and take them to heart. And there are others where you don't bother reading them or ignore them because you know that's just how they do things. And if you let yourself get too stuck into them, Neil, it can definitely affect your motivation and spirit. And so I wouldn't say this is the recommended way to go about things, but I mean, the truth is, Christian Lundgaard says almost nothing. He goes very quickly. He tends to have extremely good results. More often than not, is the fastest RLL driver at all times. And his approach to interacting with the media is very different. Who knows? Maybe that's something for Graham to try. Thank all the sponsors. Say we're going to try and do better next time. Leave it at that. Why don't we go to John Wojnar? How you doing, John? Miss you, buddy. Says, MP, hope all's going well. Question, Colton Herta seemed pretty upset at the end of the Grand Prix with his teammate Marcus Ericsson. Could there be some tension in the Andretti camp we don't know about? I haven't heard of any prior to this. Does it mean there has been none? No, just means I haven't heard of it. I know that when I bump into Kyle Kirkwood, he's a pretty happy, positive guy. I know that when I speak with Ericsson, similar thing. I know that Kirkwood, I tend to come across Kirkwood and Ericsson together or in each other's vicinity, maybe more often. I don't think that means anything negative towards Colton, but without a doubt, Colton Herta 2024 version is unlike any other version of him that we have seen, and I love every single thing about this version of Colton. Just to close this off, would say that beyond the getting hit by your teammate and it causing you to have a harder day than necessary, would say that what we're seeing in Colton's response is very likely that evolution of himself that we did not see last year, right? Last year. So through 2022, he had Alexander Rossi as the senior team member. Through 2021, was it, I believe, had Ryan Hunter-Reay as the senior driver, right? Senior member there among the drivers, the dad, the mature one who led things. Hunter-Reay gone after 21. Groschaw comes in. Groschaw was not, right, elevated to leader status. It was Rossi for sure, the older, more mature type. With Rossi gone last year, no real leader jumping out so much. I know Groschaw was by age, but I don't think by behavior, meaning I'm going to step forward and at all times be the veteran within the drivers speaking and setting the tone. That didn't happen. Also a year, an opportunity for Colton to potentially do that, but he wasn't quite ready. Needed a year, I would suggest or think, to kind of be in a little bit of limbo there and realize like, hey, you know what? I need to step up to be that leader, regardless of my age, regardless of who my teammates are. I need to be that person for the benefit of the team, but also for myself, right? I am staking a claim. I'm the man. Doesn't mean he's beating his chest and barking at the other drivers to listen to all he says. But there's been a pretty clear mental shift to how he goes about things. And so I think what you saw in his reaction to, in his post-race reaction and frustration with Ericsson was not just one of a pissed off driver got hit by his teammate, but one of like, hey man, this isn't acceptable. Big picture, thinking like a boss. Assuming what I think I'm seeing is correct, I love everything about that, John. And it goes with somebody who's running really well in the championship and I think just holding himself to a higher level of accountability, behaving in that more leader-type role among the drivers, which would then lead to a higher level of disappointment and a more sharpened, yes, we are going to have words type response. So, yeah, I don't know if I would put it down to tensions within. I think this is more just Colton leveling up and reacting in the way that he feels is best. Chuck Kazer, how are you, brother? You say MP tires being harder and less degradation this year, assuming it's the same we've had all year. coming here into IMS, should we see less speed drop-off in qualifying laps 3 and 4? Potentially. Did a interview with our friend Kara Krystolik. She is the head of Bridgestone, Firestone, Race Tires, and development and all that. Went up today on Racer talking about this exact thing. And she said, yes, the left side tires are indeed harder. Some of that's in slight reaction to last year where some teams were having higher levels of left side degradation, but also to try and work well with the added weight they expected to have with the full hybrid engine package that didn't end up happening here for the Indy 500. So she thinks we're going to be in good shape. Should not really see any negatives coming into things. So will we see left sides that handle those four laps of qualifying a little bit better? Potentially. Our pal Ryan Caminiti as well says, do we have a legitimate shot at the four-lap qualifying record this year? I think we could be close. I know we were close last year with Alex Palou's qualifying run. I think it is certainly possible. Also noting that we've taken, 25-ish pounds? I'm forgetting the exact number, but we've taken some weight off the cars with a move to some magnesium components. So the possibility's right there in front of us. What I hope is we do not have a crazy cold qualifying weekend where the cars are just way over downforced and teams can't really shed enough to get that impressive speed out of them, or we are crazy hot and even with downforce put on, we're slipping and sliding and just lacking the speed in the corners that we need. So yeah, conditions permitting, I think we should be flirting with all track records are new. New track record. Katie says, why are engines, even new ones, disintegrating? Seems like a lot of engine drama in the past couple of races. Yeah. We had two fresh, brand new motors from Honda go pop almost right away last weekend. I asked, weren't at liberty to say why or what caused. I don't even know if they had the full answers yet, but those are going back to be diagnosed. I believe we had some higher mileage motors, maybe with Pato and Rossi. Some cases, I know that some of the preseason running going on with those first motors, some of them might have needed to be changed, mileaged out a little bit sooner than expected for some teams, maybe others going, getting to the higher end of their life, which is when we sometimes see them go pop the easiest. I think we had a kind of a weird thing of two that were fresh go boom, and I think two that were getting ready for retirement and rebuilds possibly pop. So yeah, one thing to answer your question here, Katie, is to my knowledge, there's no single theme where they were all new or they were all old or whatever. Obviously, two are Chevy, two are Honda. I know we had a Felix motor blow up at Barber, and I don't remember the exact reason for that. And I think there might have been a Chevy change as well. So, yeah. Happening more than expected. Don't find or know of a single thread to go, this is what ties them all together. Okay, got about 10 minutes to go. Let's see how many we can fire through. Let's see. That's the challenge. All right, Joe Nickel. Say, were the transmission issues on the 3 car, Scott McLaughlin at Long Beach, related to the bell housing cracking you reported on? I don't know. I have heard that the magnesium transmission cases might be flexing a little bit more than desired, but I don't know the answer to this specific thing. Also ask, can any minor repairs be performed on an engine? Or are they fully sealed? They do allow minor repairs. I'd have to look at the rule book to remember exactly what it is, but it's basically if you don't have to pull the thing apart and you could do I'm paraphrasing, but a pretty quick and simple fix. Yeah, but if you're having to unseal things, major things and whatnot, there's a note. Tyler Russell, Marshall, have looked at the IndyCar rulebook and can see some minor aero tweaks have been made for this year. What's the overall consensus on downforce levels and efficiency this year versus last for the 500? How is this expected to influence the racing? We took away one or two items, things that a friend of mine said, and he was being crass, but I laughed, was, yeah, they took out a few options just to make sure nobody missed them in tech. Among key feedback that I've heard from some race engineers when I've asked about this specific thing, Tyler, the biggest thing that might stand out is the rear wing. IndyCar has allowed teams to use an additional 4 degrees of positive angle, meaning 4 extra degrees of creating downforce. They were limited to 5%, 5 degree, what am I saying percent? 5 degree inclination, that would be a nose down. They're allowed to go to 9 this year. Why that? The thing that was allowed last year, and I believe it's allowed again this year, is to use gurneys of varying height, but stand up a wee bit on the rear wing to make extra downforce. And as teams found, those wickers, those gurneys are very effective and slow the car a little bit more than they want. The extra wing angle, as I'm told, the ability to use some of that, if not all of it, is, hey, instead of bolting on that gurney, maybe you'd just rather dial in a little bit more rear wing angle during a pit stop to get that downforce you want at the back with, say, less of a straight line speed penalty. They've taken away one of the two barge boards, as they call the little tiny pieces that mount to the front of the floor. I believe they took away the shortened rear diffuser panels. Got to use the full-length ones there. I'm forgetting about what else, but other key thing to note, this is just in terms of balance to close the conversation here, Tyler, is to my knowledge, there's been nothing added at the front of the car to help balance the extra downforce that they can dial in at the rear. Usually there's some form of matching increase or decrease, right? If we're going to allow you to have more front downforce, we're going to give you an option to do more at the rear to balance that. From what I'm told, there has not been a complementing increase up front. So if you see teams adding in more rear wing at a pit stop, it's probably because they've been having a driver dealing with some significant oversteer that they're trying to combat. Hickey93, first-time questioner. So it seems like Ed Carpenter Racing has struggled for many years to regain constant footing on the grid. What can the team do to get back to the results that we saw in their prime years, 2014 through 2016? Forgetting exactly what year Newgarden joined. Was that 15? I would extend it back maybe a year or two anecdotally to Mike Conway. That guy was a badass for sure, winning races for them. They were excellent as a single car-ish type team. And I realized that Ed was doing ovals back then, I think only. And if I'm forgetting the exact dynamic of sharing the car, I apologize, it's late. But when they were fully focused on one extremely badass driver who was capable of taking that car to the front most of the time and had some, just everything was optimized for them, even though they did not have biggest budget by any means, that's when they were at their peak. Also in the early years, the DW12, just with an excellent driver like Conway on road and street courses, doing big things for them. That also worked out really well. What we've seen, how's this? I'll just give you an answer based on what happened last weekend. As I understand it, the one pit stop Renus had the same side tires mounted across the front of the car. I don't know if it was two lefts or two rights, but I heard that they mistakenly, that they got the tire sets mixed up and didn't put a left front on the left front and a right front on the right front. These tires are indeed designed to go in one direction, not both. That was one problem. It seems like operationally there's mistakes that happen more often than you would think. And some where you go, that might not be the same exact thing that happened at the last race or two races ago, but it feels somewhat familiar. And I don't want them to drop down to one car. I really hope Christian Rasmussen, who has had a brutal open to his season, many of the issues caused by himself, mistakes made, but throw in the apparent lack of funding at too many races so far in Rinus's car. I just feel for them. I was going to say I don't know what they do for a reset, but here we are the month of May at the Indy 500 portion of the event, which is where they tend to do extremely well. From the outside, I think a message of we're going to do our best to do our best. Every day we're on track. We're really and truly going to try and be excellent when we are on track. But more than that, I need us on pit lane to really be excellent, to really and truly focus on every aspect of our jobs and to be the best we can be there. Because if we do that, then we will be in a place where great things can happen on track. But if we are missing things, getting things wrong, mixing things up, be it in practice, qualifying, or the race for the big Indianapolis 500, there's almost no reason to go and do it if you are going to have the possibilities of doing well and throw them away through frequent mistakes, operational mistakes, and oversights. They're really good people who work there, who run the team throughout everything, top to bottom. There are times, and I say this as someone who's worked for some teams that have gone through some rough patches where you go, it seems like we're getting all the bad stuff out early because we keep stepping on our appendages. It just feels like whether it's drivers making mistakes on the track, team making mistakes on pit lane, setup directions wrong, strategy decisions being off. It just seems like they're stuck in a bit of a spiral. It can happen. Really, truly hope the fine folks at ECR can come out of May going, okay, I don't know if it's a win, but a positive event with no cars to repair. I think that'd be a wonderful pivot point for them for the rest of the season. Oscar Love, how you doing, brother? Says, been watching a lot of YouTube as we get closer to the 500. What would have been the social media reaction if Roger Penske had brought the beast back then, if there was social media? Probably like it was back then, which was, holy cow, that's amazing. Who would have thought of doing this? Who could have funded this? Who could have gotten all the necessary partners involved, who could have maintained the secrecy of it. Like, this was such a very specific Penske thing that I don't know if anyone else could have done it to the level that he did. But also keep in mind, if social media was alive back in 1994, it would have reflected the time and culture. So it wouldn't have been everybody overreacting about everything today. It probably would have been comparatively tame because those were the times. All right, we're into the overtime questions here. Ryan Terpstra You, Eric Franklin, you say, at what point does any NXT become completely irrelevant as a feeder series? Seems the hottest drivers are coming from F2 ranks. I mean, I don't know if I'd go that far, right? Christian Lingard has one win. I know Teo Pourchaire just got the full season minus Indy 500 opportunity with Errol McLaren and did super well on debut. But, you know, Teo isn't exactly worrying Pato or Rossi by any means right now. Marcus Armstrong just had his career best of a fifth, which is awesome. I mean, truly, it's awesome. Keep in mind, teammate Alex Palou won the race, sat on pole, led the most laps. Scott Dixon had a great qualifying as well, finished fourth ahead of him. So, again, really good result for Marcus, but he was third among the three drivers who aren't rookies within the team. And I could be forgetting someone else, but yeah, I would not go that far at all. If I'm looking at Indy NXT, which is Ryan Terpstra's question here, and looking at who we might be trying to hire next year, the one driver who stands out to me so far as really being holy cow talented plus ready for IndyCar next year, I thought that was going to be Nolan Siegel, P1, no question. Haven't seen that yet from Nolan. Been very good. Great open to the season, but have not had as big and as impressive of a run yet. The one who I'm looking at saying, I could put this guy in IndyCar tomorrow, and talking a quality front-running type car, and think that he would be super impressive, Louis Foster. I realize he's a second-year driver, just like Siegel, just like Jacob Abel. Jacob's been the breakout driver of the year, right? He's never finished worse than second across four races, right? It's not like Nolan's had a bad year either. Louis has certainly had his fair share, if not more than almost anyone else's share of adversity. But yeah, if I had to pick someone today, that'd be Foster. And hoping to see Abel continue more of what he's doing, and also for Siegel to kind of jump up and remind folks that, yeah, this guy's pretty badass. Let's go with the final question here from Impractical IG27, saying, what is the Speedway's backup plan if any this week's impending bad weather does land? I have to imagine with a high-profile rookie like Larson, they want to maximize on-track time prior to qualifying. Nothing. I mean, this ain't the first time rain's going to fall during week of practice going into qualifying. It's happened many, many times before. If we had a total washout before qualifying, I'm sure they would consider doing some special sessions and trying to move things around. But we could lose Tuesday. There could be another day based on what I saw in the forecast. But they'll have hours upon hours upon hours of running before qualifying. Even if there's a high-profile rookie like Larson, I don't foresee there being an issue. If we did have heavier amounts of rain and we had multiple days knocked out, the one thing they can do that fits and they've done before is trying to run a little earlier and go a little later. So instead of 12 to 6, do we see 11 to 7? That's the kind of thing I would expect reaction-wise to be, but I wouldn't say there's any kind of backup plan in place, barring a total washout. If they feel the need, they can extend a little bit, and that will more than do to get folks plenty of track time. Y'all, appreciate you. Thanks for sending everything in that you did. Thanks to Jerry for organizing it all. Thank you to our partners at FAF Technology, Justice Brothers, TorontoMotorsports.com for supporting us based on y'all and the great support you've given to this show for many, many years. We'll provide an update probably on my social media of what's going on here as soon as I can. Some of y'all may know my wife is very private and is not a big fan of putting all of our business out on a regular basis or a lot of details. So yeah, just keep in mind, I'll share what I can when I can, but stylistically, I always have to keep her and her preferences in mind and respect and honor those. So when I can share more, I will. And until then, thank you for listening.